Hi, I'm Andrew Corbett. Just over 100 years ago in England, there was a group of Trinity College students, which is a part of Cambridge University, who formed a society called the Midnight Society. Many of the members of the Midnight Society became professors and novelists and playwrights. This was at a time when largely Christians were looking down at the role that fiction and novels played in shaping culture. But 100 years later, the very things that the Midnight Society set out to achieve are now coming to fruition. And it was largely on a 100-year plan that they were working. Christians largely ignored the role of fiction, the art form of the novel, in communicating truth and shaping values and morals and so on. An example of this is from Hannah Moore, who wrote The Shepherd of the Salisbury Plain. She said this: "Constant familiarity with works of fiction disinclines and disqualifies for active virtues and for spiritual exercises." William Wilberforce extolled the work of Hannah Moore, and it was generally around this era that Christians were discouraged from engaging with fiction and novels. Yet the members of the Midnight Society used novels, they used fiction to great effect. The Midnight Society included people like Bertrand Russell, it included Lytton Strachey, it included novelist Thomas Hardy, and it also encompassed people who weren't actually a part of Trinity College, Cambridge, George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells, to name a couple. There were no formal requirements for being a member of the Midnight Society. The only requirement really was that they had to despise Christianity and they had to commit themselves to undermining Christianity in society. It's 10:30 p.m. The members of the Midnight Society saw Christianity as prudish and hampering society and holding it back by suppressing people's natural sexual urges. The Midnight Society intercepted with a couple of other groups. One was the Seville Club, and another one was the Bloomsbury Group. They all shared this common idea that society needed to evolve, social standards needed to evolve, and that Christianity was largely hampering that evolution of society. So they worked at promoting a different kind of morality, a morality that took bloom in the mid-20th century, and now we're seeing some of the effects of the seeds sown over 100 years ago by these people. But they don't even know. But they saw Christianity as a threat, and they reasoned that they could undermine the work of Christianity and the influence of Christians in society if they were to undermine, even destroy, two institutions that prevailed in British society. The first one was the church, and the second institution they sought to undermine was marriage. They reasoned that if they could discredit the church and undermine marriage, they could remove Christian influence from society. And the guilt that's normally associated, which they believed was a societal conditioning, could be eradicated. It itself could be removed. According to Ian Murray in his book, Undercover Revolution, How Fiction Changed Britain, he says that the members of the Midnight Society sought to make homosexuality socially acceptable. They sought to portray it in their writings and in their literature and the art that they put out, that homosexuality was natural, it was involuntary. You were born with it, you were predisposed to it, and that it certainly wasn't immoral. Times and the seasons are in your hands, but they don't even... Thomas Hardy was the most popular novelist of this time. He had an early encounter with Christianity, but for some reason turned his back on it, and he became an enemy of the church, an enemy of Christianity, and clearly an enemy of God. And Thomas Hardy made continual jibes and continual put-downs and ridicule of Christians and the church and Christian morality in his novels. In fact, some of his earliest novels, publishers refused to publish them. They were so lewd. But eventually, he prevailed. He kept at it, and his argument was he wasn't creating a new morality, he was simply writing about a morality that already existed. And he eventually came to the position that it was Christianity that was immoral because it was hampering people's natural urges. Thomas Hardy despised marriage. He was married several times himself, and his first wife, Emma, greatly disappointed him. And Emma, who became a Christian, much to Thomas Hardy's own consternation, found that although Thomas Hardy was saying that Christianity hampers happiness and represses people, that she was married to someone who was deeply unhappy and deeply repressed himself, even though during their marriage he was constantly unfaithful and constantly philandering. In other words, he was living out the philosophy that he said brought happiness and fulfillment. But Emma died prematurely. And when she died, Thomas Hardy married his long-standing mistress, a woman by the name of Florence, who was 38 years his junior. And the moment they married, she too became the object of his rejection as well. And she found the very things that Emma had spoken with others about, that Thomas Hardy was a cold, uncaring, self-centered man, and in effect he really was living out his philosophy. Thomas Hardy objected to the notion of God. He found that God was someone who was overbearing, and so he embraced the newly formed term agnostic. Thomas Hardy and the members of the Midnight Society felt intellectually justified in their position because of Charles Darwin's recent work in The Origin of the Species. They felt that this book explained how you could now view the world without any reference to God. They felt that Charles Darwin had explained how everything had begun without the need for there even being a God. And so with this somewhat fallacious intellectual footing, they built a whole new sense of morality, a morality that just do it if it feels good, do it. And of course that took bloom through the 1960s and 70s in Western society. So Thomas Hardy hated the God he didn't believe in. In fact, most of his poems and much of his literature is directed in a vitriolic sort of way, a way of despising God, which is a very curious thing for someone to do if they don't believe in that person. And hands reach over from the bedclothes warm. Charles Darwin gave these members of the Midnight Society, the Bloomsbury Group, the Seville Club, the intellectual basis for redefining morality, for their hatred of the church, their despising of marriage. They saw the church and marriage as two institutions embedded in society that was a constant reminder of God, a constant reminder that there is a God who created, and therefore, because he created, he has a right to demand a certain kind of behaviour of those he has created. By removing the church and by removing marriage, the members of the Seville Club, the Bloomsbury Group and the Midnight Society felt intellectually justified in their approach to saying that there are no restraints on how you express yourself sexually. There are no restraints on whatever your heart desires, because essentially by carrying out those desires, you are furthering social evolution. Each of the members of the Bloomsbury Group and the Midnight Society worked in their writing, in their art and their literature to present the church as dogmatic and uncaring and ugly. It worked to undermine the role and the place of church in society. It also sought to undermine marriage and to present marriage as something that was repressive and outdated and hindering social evolution. They're all sitting down to eat again. She's a single young mother, he's a noisy child. In fact, in Bertrand Russell's book, Marriage and Morals, he actually argued that sexual desire had no necessary connection with morality. If this is the case, I want you to think about this, but if this is the case, then is there anything wrong with any kind of sexual activity? Our law courts seem to think so. We have all kinds of serious sexual abuse crimes that can be committed. But if these people were right, then none of that has any warrant. And there's something intuitive in each one of us that tells us that's not right. A simple refrain so that they might even know. In many respects, the church was caught off guard with all of this. They didn't really know how to respond. We have some of the most famous preachers of the day, like Charles Haddon Spurgeon, just fumbling, not really knowing how to respond to this. And while all this was happening, he was seeing his colleagues embrace this kind of liberalism that was being encouraged by these critics, the Bloomsbury Group and the Midnight Society. And arguably, it led to Spurgeon's earlier premature death. But there were other preachers that really just struggled to know how to respond. And so the church, I think, committed some errors. And some of those errors were that it began to separate intellectual rigor with spirituality. It argued that faith was a matter of blind faith, accepting something without evidence, without fact. This is not what the Bible presents. But the opponents of the church, the opponents of the Bible, also promoted this concept that they had reason on their side and that Christianity and the church simply had faith. They began to present faith and reason as two opposites when, in fact, historically, they never were. In fact, the Bible presents faith as a reasonable thing. It calls it the evidence of things hoped for. Faith in a Christian context is not blind or unreasonable. And yet, this is what many churchmen bought into and actually promoted and gave in one sense, to this false argument. Secondly, they saw that what the Bloomsbury Group and the Midnight Society were doing was really a political campaign, and their argument was, we should have nothing to do with politics. Where the church were on a mission to save souls, we're not here to engage in politics, without realizing that this was not just about politics. This was about ideas. And the Bible says that we wage war in the realm of ideas and arguments that build strongholds in people's minds. And it's those strongholds in people's minds that will either help someone to become a Christian or hinder someone from becoming a Christian. And so when we enter into these kind of cultural debates, we're not just entering into a political campaign. We're entering into something that could result in the eternal salvation of people, or conversely, the eternal lostness of people. So these issues are critically important. Some sectors of the church, known as fundamentalists, reverted to what they called the fundamentals of the Christian faith. There were 11 essential fundamentals, they argued, and if we just keep to those things, we don't need to enter into these petty disputes and petty debates. And in essence, what they did was they actually kind of said that there's two sorts of truths. There's the secular, reasonable, scientific kind of truth, and then there's Bible truth. And yet, again, that is not what the Bible teaches. The Bible does not teach a dichotomy of truth. The Bible teaches that there's one truth. And yet, fundamentalism's greatest error is that it promoted this concept that there's two kinds of truth. That's just not what the Bible presents at all. The Midnight Society presented the church as outdated and obsolete and irrelevant and failing to move with the times, and I guess in many respects they were right. Many in the church had confused the message with the medium of the message. They had confused the packaging with the gift, and the packaging may well have looked like bells and smells and costumes and ceremonies and liturgies and tradition, when in fact none of those things were really the message. And the Bloomsbury Group and the Midnight Society made easy pickings of this kind of attack on the church. And yet, when we realise that the message is the gift to the world, the packaging can change. And so the church had failed to keep its message in an understandable way, in a relevant way. Of course, today there are churches that understand relevance. They actually forget about the gift in some respects, and they worry about the packaging more than the gift. There is a balance to be had here where we can be relevant, we can be contemporary, we can be understandable without compromising. The Bloomsbury Group led questionably moral lives. They flaunted their sexuality, often in what shocked the public at the time. But when the church pointed this out, they were very quick to point out that the church itself had failed to live up to the moral standards that it was trying to defend. And unfortunately, that was true. The church had failed in many respects to live up to the moral standards that it was supposedly defending. This is completely unacceptable. But notice this, if the messenger fails to live up to the standards of the message, it doesn't make the message any less true. One of the most glaring strategic errors the church had made was that it failed to translate the gospel as summed up in the statement, Jesus Christ is Lord. There was a failure to make that understandable, recognizable, and translated into the public square. As Christians, when we say Jesus Christ is Lord, for us it's not just a Christian concept, it's a universal concept. Jesus is not just Lord if you make him Lord. And I know there's the appeal to make Christ Lord of your life, but Christ is already Lord of your life. He already is Lord. You may not live as if he is, but he is. And the church had failed to translate this wonderful message that Jesus Christ is Lord into the public arena. It almost excused inappropriate behavior. It excused uncivilized behavior. It was, well, what can you expect? They're not Christians. They are not subject to the Lordship of Christ. But that's not true. The statement, Jesus Christ is Lord, is exceptionally relevant in the marketplace, in the halls of academia, in the public square. And the church had failed to communicate that, and it had failed to do it with any degree of passion. Another mistake that the church had made was falling into this false idea of what separation of church and state meant. It had allowed secularists to define the separation of church and state in a way that said that the church cannot even speak to secular matters, cannot even speak into the secular arena. Of course, this makes two great errors. Firstly, it puts a line of distinction between what is sacred and what is secular without realizing that all of life is sacred. From the most mundane things, they are sacred. And of course, the most sacred thing, which secularists claim is the most secular of things, is the act of sex. Sexual activity is not just a physical activity. It is intimately and intrinsically a sacred activity. And the church had failed to communicate this. It had allowed this false idea of what the separation of church and state meant to mean that the church could in no way be engaged in the public debate over any issue at all. And of course, the idea that there are certain things that are sacred and certain things that are secular, if you ask, well, what's sacred? The answer is whatever takes place within your four walls on a Sunday, that's all. That's an absurd notion. The separation of church and state means that the church doesn't try to run the state and the state doesn't try to run the church. It doesn't mean that we can't hold each other accountable, and the church has failed to make this case. When faced with an inability to know how to answer the secularists when they were coming out with these novels and literature, and later on, of course, they were making films and video games and the like, what some in the church did, which was a great strategic error, was to withdraw from the genre altogether. They made certain things taboo. At one point, there were some churches that even banned Disneyland. And so rather than engage with the genre, rather than offer an alternative, rather than offer at least an interpretation of the genre, the church just simply put their hand up and said, we make that a taboo, we won't even go there. And yet today there are some really good Christian authors and really good Christian novelists who are engaging in the genre. Sigmund Brau would be one of the world's leading Christian fictional writers. His stuff is brilliant. It's really good. And it engages in the level of being able to use genre, the genre of the novel, very, very well. I encourage you to read some of his books. They are very good. And so rather than just simply retreat and withdraw from the genre, as Christians, we can take the genre. If it's bad, we can interpret it and show why it's bad. For some people, Harry Potter is a very divisive issue. And yet, if we look at the New Testament, we see the Apostle Paul using pagan poets. But he interpreted it in a way that opened the door to the sharing of the gospel. And in the same way, it actually is possible to look at the story of Harry Potter without simply saying we black ban it or we make it a taboo, and we can interpret it. We can put a Christian perspective on as we look at and examine the story of Harry Potter. We can see good versus evil, a biblical theme. We can see life, death, and resurrection, a biblical theme. We can see these sorts of things. We can see a connection between the spiritual realm and the physical realm, again, a biblical theme. I would encourage you, if you have been someone who has disengaged from the genre that the world uses, I invite you to re-engage. Of course, there are Christians who've used the genre of this kind of fantasy writing, such as C.S. Lewis in the Chronicles of Narnia, that are overtly Christian. They make a wonderful contribution to conveying the Christian message. Of course, some might believe that the church has got no problems at all at the moment, that we actually are taking ground. After all, look at some of the mega churches that are around. Some of these churches number in the tens of thousands, and surely if the church is looking like that, we're taking ground and we're doing well. But you'd be deceived. You'd be deceived by the actual data. The actual data says that with the rise of the mega church, that the actual number of Christians, both in America, Great Britain, and Australia and New Zealand, is actually diminishing. We're not taking the kind of ground that Christ deserves. What can we do about this? I think we need to re-engage. I think we need to re-engage in the political arena and make our case for the Lordship of Christ, not in a way that we seek to take over society. We're not looking for a church state. A church state would be something where we would regulate and legislate that everyone must attend church. We don't even want to go there. We're not proposing that at all. In fact, a church state would look like where everyone must belong to a particular church and must attend there. A church state would look like you're actually taxing to the church, not to the state. We're not proposing that. We're not talking about that at all. But what we are talking about is the fact that the church does have something to say about current contemporary issues, and we should be saying it. All too often we're intimidated by the bluster and the rhetoric. We're intimidated by the almost abusive language where we get labelled with all kinds of things like intolerant, bigot, homophobes and all this. And that is just not helpful. It's especially not helpful if we're being intimidated by it. So I think we need to re-engage. I think we also need to encourage people in our church who are gifted in the arts to be able to take the gospel and to be able to communicate it in the genre of the novel, in the genre of film and media and production, and be able to use poetry and sculpture and photography to the glory of Christ, to be able to engage people with the claims of Christ and be able once again to paint the backdrop of the gospel so that when we pastors preach on a Sunday, the gospel is somewhat understandable. We are now behind the eight ball. We have a lot of catch up to do. But note this, the ideas that are sown in one generation often don't take bloom. They don't come to fruition for three or four generations down the track. And so today, we have the opportunity to sow ideas back into our culture, to be able to sow the message of God's love and Christ's lordship to a world that's been told that if there is a God, he's a part of the trees, the nature, the air, and he's a part of the universe, when in fact, he has revealed himself through Jesus Christ. He has revealed himself through God made flesh. This God made flesh, called the Son of God, prayed to God his Father. And so he said that he would go and send the Holy Spirit. And so we see the revelation of God has been made clear, that he is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He is a personal God, and he is Lord of the universe. And we as the church can once again engage our culture with these kinds of claims. We can sow ideas about morality is sacred. We can sow good ideas about sexuality is sacred. It's not just physical. We can sow ideas that there aren't multiple ways to find God. There aren't multiple expressions of God. There is one God. If God has revealed the best way to find him, by definition, that means there's one. And that one claimed to be Jesus Christ. That was his claim. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I've written more about this. I've expanded on what we should do and can do as a church. And you'll find that on findingtruthmatters.org. If you go to articles, you'll see Novel Doubt, my latest article there, where I talk more about this. If you'd like more information about how we can engage culture, I encourage you to read Ian Murray's book, Undercover Revolution, How Fiction Changed Britain. I also encourage you to get my ebook, Why Christians Should Get Involved. In those books, you'll see the bigger picture at play here, and it might help you to get a fresh vision for what the church can look like, not in a year, but in 100 years.